Welcome to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Andra Skoggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Andra Skoggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I am joined by local talent, longtime friend, and our producer, Mr. Mark Turcotte.
That works for me.
Together, we explore how incredible people, the voices of Andra Skoggin, build, lead, and thrive while contributing to a better quality of life for all. Thanks, Mark.
Of course.
Mr. Mark Turcotte.
I'm surprised you didn't want a countdown today.
I was waiting for it, but you said you were ready, and I thought maybe I should just be professional today. Okay. But he usually gives me a really great hand countdown and gets me all excited.
We start at five, and then we can't say the last two, because in the biz, that's how they do it.
It just brings such an energy. If you want that full experience, I'm sure he would do it. I do live for it. No, did you see me like... No, just done. Okay.
Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't see it.
I never don't want the countdown.
You can vouch for me. I did start.
I didn't see it.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I jumped.
I tried to make it official.
I love that. I love that you did it throughout the trade show. Each time I just got more and more excited. Apparently there's no limit to what that does for me. And it's just like, yay. Yes. Anyway, no worries. So I'm joined today by Jane Van Bramer. She is Sweet President and Chief Executive Officer. She's brought with her today Elizabeth Smith, her Community Relations Associate. Ladies, say hello.
Hello.
Hello,
thank
welcome.
You for having us.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be here.
We're super excited. I'll tell folks just a little bit more about Jane. Jane has devoted her entire 30 plus working years to behavioral health. She came to Sweetser almost 3 years ago from Oklahoma, where she led the revitalization of a psychiatric hospital and outpatient service. The majority of her career was spent with the New York State Office of Mental Health, where she led the largest public mental health system in the country. That's a big job. Wow. As the Senior Associate Commissioner for state-operated children's and adult services. Jane believes recovery is possible for every person with a behavioral health diagnosis and that successful treatment is evidence-based and holistic. She has two master's degrees. I'm not sure how you squeezed that in this epic career that you've had. One is in psychology and one is in applied research and evaluation. She has lived experience with an immediate family member and is the proud grandmother of five adored grandchildren. She looks forward to a world where mental health stigma is eliminated and access to treatment and recovery is possible for all. I absolutely love that. We're going to dive into that today. So we're going to talk a little bit more. That is an incredible, wide-ranging career. And five grandchildren to boot.
Absolutely.
So I'm still at the children phase. I have four children. They're 18 through 20. And I hear grandchildren are so great, most people would have skipped right to that stage.
Absolutely.
I haven't quite figured out how that works. My stepmother got that experience. She didn't have children of her own. She still gets to be called Mimi. And I would have signed up for that if I knew it was an option. But five grandchildren.
Yes, being a grandmother is your reward for getting through those teenage years with your children.
So that's the light at the other.
It is the light.
I'll continue to hold it high for. I don't want to rush it. I don't want to be a grandmother tomorrow, but I do look forward to that stage.
Nothing better.
I would be okay to be an empty nester at this point. I'll just take them in stages. That would be amazing to me.
I'm about a month away from being an empty nester.
You have it on the horizon?
I can't wait. I can see the light.
And you're so confident no one's coming back?
We're going to board up their rooms. We're not turning it into an exercise room or a yoga studio.
You're just going to board it off?
We're going to board it up.
Now you've got me thinking.
Sorry.
I was like, so you're going to go when you're okay. So I'm like, all right, if I move that piece of furniture here, I'm like already in my head redecorating and knowing like could be 2 years, could be 4 years before I get that space back. Yeah. Boarding it up was not on my mind, but I have to say the turntable style experience I've had so far actually puts that lead in the suggestions that I might follow.
You should consider it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like they'll call us in a year or two and we'll be like, yep, same house, just one bedroom now. Who knew?
I don't know what happened, babe. The whole floor plan shifted.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know what happened. It's the housing market or something.
See, and you don't have any grandchildren, Mark.
No.
That's not on the horizon for you anytime soon.
Correct.
Yeah. See? So what's your age range of the five grands?
Oh, like 6 months, And 212 to 12 years.
Oh, so, you've got a little baby in
there.
We do. Babies smell nice.
Love baby smell.
It's really, it really goes downhill after 12.
Absolutely.
Teenage years,
very tough.
Oh, enjoy the snuggle stage.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. We will start today with just a little segment that we like to call Getting to Know You.
Okay.
What do you think, Mark?
I don't know if we should put them through that. We used to sing.
Oh my goodness.
And then it came, it's not good.
We used to sing, Getting to Know You.
Please don't misunderstand. It's not good.
We received complaints, so we stopped.
Oh, no. And then we received requests.
Right.
For your songs.
It might have been one person. I think
it was.
I think there was two people who strongly...
I'm sure it can't be that bad. It can't be that bad.
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad.
Maybe just hum.
Yeah. I don't know that I...
Or I can just introduce the song.
Yeah, all right. Folks, if you want to hear that, come back. We're going to really need a lot of strong support to find a way through.
First couple of episodes, check it out. We really tried, and then we just gave up.
Failure's about learning, Mark.
That's true. Our first segment is called Getting to Know You, where we ask guests fun, personality-revealing questions to help you learn about and connect with our guests on a personal level. Before we get into the deeper questions, this is like the appetizer before the main course.
Love that. Little nibbles.
Yeah.
So is today a sweet or savory appetizer? Let's find out.
Let's find out.
Jean, what's something people are always surprised to learn about you?
Let's see. I would probably say that I love to ice skate. And I used to teach ice skating and then didn't do it for like 20 years. And when I moved to Maine, I reinitiated my passion for ice skating. So,
and you still do it all the time?
I do it a lot.
Weather
yes.
depending. That's
yeah.
I would not have expected that. And not because it's you, I wouldn't have expected, but I've tried skates a couple times. And I think that's where my bias comes from. If I was to be really honest, I just don't see how anyone gets around on skates.
No,
that's incredible. Do you do the backwards?
Yes.
And the spins and the...
I used to do a lot of spins. Now I do kind of like baby spins.
Yeah.
But I do some of that, yeah.
Where's your favorite place to go ice skating?
I go to the indoor arena in Portland.
Oh, see? Yeah. Do you ever do the outside ones? I had a couple of friends. There was like early days this season when the ice had just frozen and it was this like crazy clear ice and they were able to see right through it and they said that was one of their best ice skating experiences
really?
Ever. Yeah. They did it on like riverways, like in their little like kind of, I think they live in a semi-marshland and so they were able to kind of skate through land in some ways.
That sounds very cool.
Doesn't it?
No, I've kind of shied away from that. It makes me a little nervous to be on a...
So that's how I feel about skates in general. Thanks, now we understand each other.
Commonality.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. Elizabeth,
I'm
going to ask you the same question.
Yeah.
Something that people might be surprised to learn about you.
I think, I don't know that many people know this about me, but I definitely love art and I love to draw. I love to paint, I love to draw. Anything artistic, I really enjoy it. I don't get a lot of time to do it, but I like to be creative in that way.
Do you have a favorite medium?
I think, I used to love oil paints, and I still do, but I've been experimenting recently with watercolor.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Watercolor is, it's the only type of art that, like, I do consistently and find kind of, like, almost a meditative state in.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents did oil, and I want to do oil, and I was mentioning that to a close friend who knows me far too well recently, and she's like, Shanna, you can't do oil. It takes forever to dry, and the way that you, like, rotate through, you would just need a room to store the paintings that you're drawing.
That's why I love oil, though, because it takes forever to dry and you can go back and fix it. And then you just, that's the only way I'm able to do it. Yep.
I think that would play to the perfectionist in me in an unhealthy way. Like, it would never be done.
Right.
I would just never be done with an oil painting.
Constantly touching up.
I appreciate that, though. I think arts is such a great way to engage a whole side of my brain that in my day-to-day I don't get to use as much. And the same is true probably for ice skating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the ability to engage your body when your mind is going. Do you
absolutely.
Find that balance
it's relaxing.
There?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love a good outlet. If you had a personal motto or mantra right now, what would that be?
That's easy. And it would be no risk, no gain. And for me, I don't believe that I am reckless, but I do believe that to make like breakthrough improvements in behavioral health and to lead an organization, you have to be bold sometimes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no risk, no gain.
Do you ever find, I sometimes am surprised at how rare people name risk and risk adversity in conversations around planning, around goal setting, around relationship building, work relationship, and personal as well. Like I think it is such a key factor that is underpinning so many choices that we make individually all the time as people, as professionals, as organizations, and I don't feel like we talk about risk enough. So I love that that's your motto.
It absolutely is. I think, you know, people are generally kind of adverse to change, and risk requires change. But, you know, as I say, nothing can ever get better without change.
Yeah.
And we can all grow and improve, and we can all do better. So, yeah, I would say
I think that's exactly right. Gotta take a chance. Do you take risks, Elizabeth?
I try to. I think that I have to piggyback on that a little bit. I think do the uncomfortable thing is something I try to keep in the back of my mind at all times, because I think that's the only way that good things come about in your life is when you're kind of uncomfortable and you do take the risk. So I have to absolutely agree with
that. It's an adventure.
It is. Right? You never know where it's going to take you.
You two are a good pair, because could you imagine if it was the opposite?
Yes.
Spending all day kind of feeling stifled, like don't step off that curb, go to the corner, right? No, I think that's I really love that as a mantra. Say it again.
No risk, no gain.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that it's gain and not reward. Because I think sometimes that gets a little shifted. And reward is something very different than gain.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. I like it when people choose their words wisely. I find it happens less and less these days. So it's always it's always nice. I revel in that. Okay, what is one small thing you do every day that helps you lead well or stay grounded?
So for me, I believe strongly in sleep hygiene. So I sleep 8 hours every night. I go to bed by 10 o'clock. I get up way before I leave for work. I get up 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm a coffee addict, I'll admit it. I like to have several cups of coffee.
My respect points just skyrocketed for you. I don't know how I trust people who don't drink a lot of coffee.
Exactly. Yes. But my 8 hours of sleep are really important to me.
Yeah. Is that hard?
Not really, not for me.
No.
I like to sleep, and I just feel energized, you know, like we go, go, go during the day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I need to be, it grounds me, it, you know, it just, it works.
I believe it, I just really struggle to make it happen.
It's important. It correlates to health and longevity.
Yeah. And cortisol and stress.
Yeah,
and
absolutely. Your mind unwinds. It's all good for you.
Do you get 8 hours, Elizabeth?
I do try to. I try to get as much sleep as possible because I think it does play into the rest of your life. I think things kind of fall into place when you know, are rested, and it takes care of everything else. So,
There was some testing done, and people who hadn't slept were more dangerous than people who were over the alcohol limit when driving.
I believe that.
For what that's worth.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it makes complete sense.
Yes.
All right, you ready to get into the main course?
Sure.
Ladies, gent, I got a couple of questions, but I really, when we read your bio, when I learned a little bit more about your history, I mean, it led me to a whole bunch of different directions that we could go in. But here's our starting point.
Okay.
You've led massive systems in New York, transformed services in Oklahoma, and now lead Sweetser in Maine. What common threads have run through your approach to leadership across these places that really reflect urban, rural, dense, not dense, very different environments, very different geographies? What are some of the pieces that have kind of tied that together for you, particularly through your lens of leadership?
That's a great question. And, you know, I would say one of the things that shines through in terms of how I lead is my passion for behavioral health. That, you know, I believe so strongly that, you know, anyone who suffers from a mental health or substance use disorder can get better and can be well. And I believe we have almost a moral responsibility to provide those interventions that we know work, that evidence-based, research-based interventions.
That's that evaluation degree coming.
That is that
evaluation. Yeah, I like that.
I'm also a leader that doesn't like to use their gut. I like to use data to make decisions, and I think data-based decisions are more accurate. I also, especially with, you know, my leadership team, I am very transparent. You know, kind of what you see is what you get with me. If I'm annoyed, you know I'm annoyed.
Yeah.
But I also get over things. Every day is a new day, and we start at, you know, we start from the beginning again. But I think, you know, those are kind of like the common themes. I think there's been different issues or different challenges in each one of my jobs, including Sweetser, that has kind of brought out a different leadership style. But in general, you also try to give people what they need.
Yeah.
So I have some folks who might work for me who I might talk to once every 3 weeks and just pop into their office. I have other folks that I speak to every day.
Yeah.
So you try to give people what they need and what will help them grow and develop. You always give them credit. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need the credit anymore. You know, I'm at the end of, towards the end of my career. So when something good happens, when I meet with the board, I'm talking about, you know, my CFO's accomplishments, my chief program officer's accomplishments, because nothing good would happen for mm-hmm. me and my leadership if it wasn't for them, and if it wasn't for the staff at large. They're the ones who make the magic happen, not the CEO. So I think kind of pointing that out, reminding staff of the difference they make. Mm-hmm. You know, our staff at Sweetser, they're committed, they're compassionate, they change lives every day. It's amazing what we do. And just reminding them of that kind of drives them through to get through those tough days.
Yeah. When I think about the career that you've had, the places that you've had it in, I also believe in servant leadership, which I think you've put great voice to, as you self-described there. But it really is about what people need. And it's not just that you were in different geographies, but you were in different geographies.
Cultures.
and cultures at vastly different times. Mm-hmm. And so when I think, I grew up north of here, and my dad worked at Bangor Mental Health Institute.
Okay.
And so I know what mental health care looked like in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I heard about what mental health care looked like for my dad with his mother when he was a child, and when the same place that he worked then was a very different place of, I don't know that care is the right word for what folks were doing in the
It was custodial
60s.
Care is
yeah,
what it was.
Thank you.
Yes.
Well, even the word care seems a little more caring than some of these
custodial containment.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, right. Caring. Like that was exactly the case. And so your career's not just navigated different needs and different places and different teams and different programs, but different times. What is the most significant thing that you have seen change in your career? And I'm sure there's many, so you know, feel free to have two if you need it.
Okay. First thing I'd say is the use of peers, that is, individuals with lived experience.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started in this field, they were patients.
Yeah.
And now they are coworkers, and they do bring something wonderful and different to the treatment milieu. When you have someone who's struggling with a substance use disorder or a mental health disorder, to talk to someone who's walked into their shoes and is already far along in their recovery journey is just fabulous. So the fact that we've been able to hire, we have a youth peer, we have a family peer, we have an adult peer support specialist, all in our Lewiston Hope and Healing Center. The fact that we can offer that to folks is just fabulous. You know, we still have a little bit of a ways to go there. I would like to, you know, make sure we can get reimbursed for all their individual services and stuff. But being able to do that, I think, is great. The other difference I've noticed, I would say it still exists, but stigma and discrimination is much better than it was 30 plus years ago. When I worked for a state hospital, there was a fire in one, not our hospital, but in another state hospital. The headlines of the newspaper read roasted nuts. You wouldn't see that today.
No.
But there still is, and I wouldn't even call it stigma, I would call it discrimination, that does exist in terms of not just the services, but individuals who suffer from mental health or substance use disorders. And that evidences itself in terms of parity and reimbursement rates. But also, you know, when I ran hospitals, I used to say that, you know, the nightstands of my patients were not covered with get well cards and flowers.
Yeah.
And if you have a child that's going in for a substance use treatment, you know, if your child's going in for cancer treatment, your neighbors are making you casseroles and cleaning your house. Does that happen if your child is suffering from a substance use disorder and going in, you know, for rehab? Probably not. Right. And you might not tell people because you're ashamed.
Yeah.
You know, the example I like to give staff is that, you know, how comfortable would you feel tomorrow calling into work for a mental health day?
Yeah.
Most people will say, I have a fever, or I'm not feeling well.
Yeah.
They're not going to say, you know, I'm just down in the dumps today, I need to take a break.
Yeah.
And that's the stigma and discrimination. That although better, it's not as blatant.
Right.
We're more careful with our words. I mean, you know, I start to see very few people say someone committed suicide because we know it's not a crime.
Right.
We talk about they completed suicide or they died by suicide. I'm starting to see less of people equating people with their illnesses.
Yeah.
You might have seen, you know, 20 years ago, somebody say, Sarah is schizophrenic. Would we say Sarah is cancer?
Right.
No, of course not.
Right.
So, you know, I think now we are careful to say, has a diagnosis of or is a person with.
Yeah.
Because we know they're a daughter, they're a parent, they're an artist, they're a musician. There are many things. They're not their illness.
Yeah. I know here in this organization, with my own experiences and with my own leadership style, that like we do have staff call in and say they need a mental health
day.
That's
great.
Yeah, I think creating that culture.
Yeah.
That kudos to this team because you can't get to a good culture by yourself.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And so yeah, kudos to this team.
That's
but
great.
It's just such a different way to explain how you're not feeling well and to be trusted. To know yourself enough that you know that you're not feeling well. And so I'm glad that you were hearing that this and seeing that the stigma is changing.
It is
still there, but it
better.
Hasn't improved.
I mean, look at Simone Biles. You know, the fact that she was able to step out of the Olympics and, you know, be open about her mental health challenge. I think when actors and athletes, you know, step out and step up, it makes it easier for other people to do it. And, you know, so we try to lead by example. I also had a sister who had a serious and persistent mental illness. So I also approach this from the aspect of being a family member and knowing the challenges of that. And I think that has also impacted my leadership style. So I'll say to people, this is personal to me.
Yeah.
I'll admit it.
Yeah. You talk about bringing lived experience as a family member of someone with a behavioral health diagnosis in your bio and just now. How has that shaped the way that you lead and advocate? How does that show up for you?
It shows up.
And has
up
it always showed up? I'm sorry, but like, has it always been?
No, I remember when my sister first got ill, she got her MSW from Fordham University, was working in the mental health field. Within a couple of years, she had a psychotic break. We had to intercept her. She was on her way to Kennedy Airport to fly to Russia to save the world. I mean, she was pretty sick.
Yeah.
And I remember bringing her to the hospital and meeting with the psychiatrist the next day, and he painted a story for my mother and I that was so grim and so hopeless that she would need to be, this was a degenerative disease, she'd never get any better, she'd need to be taken care of her entire life. And when I think back on that, it wasn't that this was a bad psychiatrist or a mean psychiatrist. It is what we knew about mental health and behavioral health 30 plus years ago.
Yeah.
We weren't talking about recovery. We didn't understand that even individuals with serious and persistent mental illness can recover and be well, that they can, you know, live good lives. Maybe not the exact same life, but
right.
still a good life. But more in direct response to your question, I also remember back then not telling people about my sister. I remember, you know, being worried that people were thinking that I was going to get it. And, you know, probably 20 years ago, I started to incorporate it into speeches and when I'd go out to talk to folks. And invariably, at the end, there'd be a line at the podium where people would say, you know, my sister, my mother, my aunt, my coworker. And so then I started to talk about that this really does impact everyone. One out of five people will have a diagnosable mental illness in any given year. So that's, you know, I saw somebody out there. That's one of us.
Yeah. No, you know? I mean, I think with the numbers in our office building right now, it's like one and a half. Like one and a better chance of two, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, one out of six will have a substance use disorder during their lifetime. One out of 20 will have a serious mental illness like my sister. I mean, this does impact everyone. And if you don't know anyone, it's just because they're too ashamed to come out and tell you.
It's that. Mm-hmm. It's that. No, I think that's right. Had you already started your career?
I had, yeah. I got my first job at Manhattan Psychiatric Center in graduate school. I remember walking onto the grounds of that hospital. It had three towering buildings. We had 1,300 inpatients. It was loud. It was chaotic. People were screaming. I remember I was scared.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, we had 45 individuals on a unit that was meant for 30. You had people tied to gurneys in the hallway. And I'm ashamed to say there was smoke everywhere. Because then we let people smoke. We gave out state cigarettes. Yeah. We had these white cartons.
Not just patients, but doctors too.
Everybody was smoking. Yeah. And then we had these big, like, airplane-like exhaust fans running, and it was noisy, and it was incredible, incredible.
Oh. And you went back the next day.
I did go back and the next day. I thought I'd only work for the state 3 years or so. Like 34 years later, I retired from New York State. Took another job, but I did retire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I like to think that I had understanding and appreciation for things that had never touched my life, and then there's been a number of examples. Unfortunately, mental health touched my life at a very young age, so I don't have much memory of that not being a part of my life. But like the minute that you have something that you think you understand and then you experience it in a firsthand way, all of a sudden it helps you realize just the little biases that you didn't even know you hold, that weren't necessarily outright or formed opinions, you know, that what people think of. For me, I remember, it's funny that you mentioned scared. I know that a number of the times that I chose not to tell people about what my experiences were was much more related to being scared that they would judge my family member or that they would witness an episode that seemed scary and that would scare them and not have the empathy or love or care that I had in those moments. Mm-hmm. And so it's complex and nuanced, right? There's a million layers to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I absolutely think so.
And that's not the stuff you're trying to explain to your classmate or to your coworker or to your boss, right?
No.
Which is a little different than dad's in stage 3 chemo care and he's getting his radiation. Like, we'll go into details and milligrams and the trip for cancer care, but for treatment for mental health or substance use disorder, we tend to... They're just in rehab. It's a simple step. It's one step. They just did this little thing.
It's just something that happened before.
Yeah.
Yes. It touches everyone. I mean, I can speak to it as well. Yeah. I mean, I have a close family member who, you know, has struggled with substance use. And I think that was a big part of what drew me to Sweetser. You know, I don't have a background in behavioral health or social work, but this has really, you know, really been such an important thing for me to go and pursue after I saw that lived experience with my you know, family member. So I think we're all touched by it, and we all need to come to terms with it, you know.
I will say for both of you, every time I meet somebody who feels connected to their work by deep purpose, man, they like their jobs better. They show up different. They are committed to their work. Purpose-driven. When somebody really loves what they're doing and understands what value it brings to someone else. And it doesn't always have to be deep service work. I think it's... sorry, it's an audio podcast, and you can't see the general beaming of these two women shining through. But it's just always refreshing, and I love to call it. As someone who loves... I love what I do, and I know that. Yeah, I know
that. You can see that.
Yes. Right? Yes. See, you can, like,
through.
You...
It does.
You just, it shows through.
Yeah.
You've spoken about reducing stigma and increasing access. What are the biggest barriers, you think, to achieving those goals in Maine right now? Which is a different way than if I'd asked that question, say, a year ago.
Absolutely.
I'm curious.
Right now, the most significant barrier to increasing services is workforce. You know, you can't have services without staff, and especially clinicians, social workers, licensed clinical professional counselors. They are hard to hire in Maine, and I think it's a very tough job. So we actually have several pieces of legislation that we're trying to push through this year, because we would be able to expand services if we could hire more folks.
Yeah.
I also think there are some unique things about Maine in terms of an aging workforce, mm-hmm. the rural nature of a lot of the counties, which makes it really hard to reach some of those areas. Last year, a point-in-time study was done by the state chapter of the Social Work Association and the Alliance for Behavioral Health and Substance Use Organizations, and they found over 10,000 people in Maine on a waiting list waiting for therapy.
Yeah.
10,000 people, and not all the agencies responded, so that's a low number. So what does that mean? If you don't get services, or if you're put on a waiting list for 10 months or 7 months, what does that mean? It means you get worse.
Yeah.
It means you get worse, and then you end up accessing higher and more expensive level of care. Mm-hmm. You end up in an emergency room, or you end up, you know, hospitalized.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say workforce is definitely the biggest challenge.
Hmm.
This work is not easy.
No.
And it's not paid exceptionally well. So, you know, you really have to look for people who have the passion.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they have to be able to support their family.
Yeah.
They need to be able to buy a home. They need to be able to live in Maine.
Yeah.
So those are our challenges. We really work hard on creating a culture where our staff feel valued. We do a lot of employee engagement stuff. We really have reduced our attrition significantly in the past 3 years.
Nice work.
Thank you.
Yeah, congrats.
But we still have a hard time getting clinicians. So two of the bills we're advocating for, I was testifying yesterday in Augusta. We have a bill that is creating an alternative pathway for social workers. We know the national social work exam is biased towards older applicants and people of color. So what some other states have done is, if you fail your exam, we're going to give you an alternative path to be licensed. You'll have more supervised hours, you'll have more oversight, but you can still get fully licensed. So we're trying to push that forth in Maine. The other thing that we really want is automatic reciprocity. You know, a lot of people have heard about the compact nurse's degree, which is if you have a license in 20 states, you can work in any of those states. So last year, social work passed the compact for Maine, and a few years ago, they passed the license LCPC compact. The problem is, you have to get these 20 or 25 states together to agree on minimal qualifications and to work through the process when they might meet once a month as a group.
Yeah.
This is going to take years.
Yeah.
We can't wait years.
No.
We have a mental health crisis in Maine, especially with our youth. So we're asking for legislation that would, if you've worked in another state for at least 2 years and you have no disciplinary action in that state, you can automatically come to Maine and we're going to give you a license, but you have to work in an organization or a hospital, because you know what? We supervise all our clinicians.
Yeah.
We have a structure, we do audits, we do reviews. It's not like you can come and hang up a shingle and work independently.
Right.
So I think that will help. And then the third bill is a workforce bill, which we're asking for. You know, there's been several studies done on workforce. Sweetser led one. We had a John T. Gorman grant last year on what are some of the workforce challenges for clinicians to serve kids. We know what some of the solutions are. We need kind of to move it to the next step,
yeah.
more like an implementation plan. You know, we're hearing there's not a lot of money this year, so rather than just asking for a big ticket to be able to implement some of these, we thought we'd get a group together and try to do a plan that would be presented maybe in 2 years or
yeah.
next year. So that's our legislation in terms of workforce.
Let's get it done.
I would love to. Love to get it done.
So you might not know this about us. We're nowhere near as big as Sweetser, but by general chamber standards, particularly in Maine, our work is broader than a lot of chambers. And so under the umbrella of our work, which includes all the traditional things, we are not shy on events and networking, professional development, business development. We come through, promise. We do regional marketing and promotion for the area, and for us, that's about talent attraction and retention. And so that's one of our key economic and workforce strategies, and all that's kind of under the chamber umbrella. And then we also have, through our foundations, we also have a 501c3, because chambers are traditionally C6s, which is why I can effectively lobby. And if you tell me those LD numbers, I can get after them.
Absolutely.
Which is nice in that space. But in our foundations activities, We have a couple of different programs that folks wouldn't naturally think about, and we don't have an ego, so we don't blast our branding or logo all over them, but Strength in LA is one. Mm-hmm. Strength in LA is a workforce development program. We have an employment opportunity coach who works directly with career seekers to help remove barriers, to transfer degrees and credentials, to help them get both education and work and or whatever their goals are. So it's very driven by them. And then we have a network coordinator who works directly with 46 of our, and it's more employers than that, but we have 46 private and public partners in the network itself. And we focus specifically on three industries, and one of them is healthcare. So healthcare, construction and manufacturing, and then early childhood development are three of pillars. Well, and it's data driven. I love data too. Yeah, I don't need a master's in evaluation to get jazzed by a good data set. And so healthcare is our top known gap in our workforce locally. The other, I would say, construction and the trades is a big gap as well. Mm-hmm. Both of them are well-paid, laddering career pathways that can sustain families, which is kind of one of our focus. And then the third's early childhood development. Admittedly, mm-hmm. while there is a significant gap, it is not one of our higher-paying sectors. We'd love to see that change.
Absolutely.
But it's such a key factor to being successful in our strategies in the other two industries. And so we know a lot about the workforce shortage gaps, particularly in the healthcare industry, and those along with housing, because it is a very linked barrier to meeting our workforce goals, are some of our advocacy priorities every year, and this year in particular. And so, just saying, when I say let's get it done, I mean it. Well, let's work on that.
The LD number for the workforce bill is LD 1426.
Yeah, that's one I'm tracking. I was wondering. There's so many.
Oh, actually, no, that's the ACT one. I'm sorry, it's LD 1380.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
That is the workforce one, and I will have to get you the
feel free to email me there or send them
yes,
to me.
Absolutely.
Because there's a number of bills we're tracking, and there's so many under the header of workforce, like a 4-day work week bill, and like there's a lot, and it's not that it wouldn't be nice to see many of them maybe implemented, but when the budget is what it is this year, that the legislature is having to grapple with, and the needs are what they are right now, we try to be strategic about which ones can get done and which ones are going to have the most impact.
Well, I think the reciprocity and the alternative pathway has really no cost.
Yeah.
To me, they're no-brainers.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just got to create
additional
clinicians.
I can't see why reciprocity wouldn't make sense.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because Maine is beautiful. People would move here.
Mm-hmm. That's why we're also working on housing, because they would if there was a place to live.
That's
that
true.
Is true.
LA is killing it on.
Yes.
This county, we're
yes,
killing
you
it
are.
On that particular.
Yes, you
that
are.
Thank you.
Yes.
We're working on it. It is. It's some of the key strategies that we've been... we've been focused on.
Yes.
What gives you hope right now about the future of behavioral health in Maine and or the country?
So one of the programs I like is a program we have right here in Lewiston, and that's our Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic, our CCBHC, or what we call, because no one likes to say that, our Hope and Healing Center.
Yeah.
Which is a compendium of 9 evidence-based services. It's really a soup-to-nuts program. But what I love most about it is we have walk-in hours.
Yeah.
That you can walk in and get help. And, you know, that's new for behavioral health. You know, medical services have been doing
all you get for walking is the ER, right? I mean,
that's what walking is
for a really long time.
But
yes.
We actually, on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, you can walk in to our Hope and Healing Center in Lewiston and be served. You can get a full assessment by a licensed clinician. We have a care coordinator talk to you about what your needs are, you know, what kind of services we have. There are some services that you can get immediate access to. Our youth peer, our med management, medication, you can get immediate access to those services. Clinical services with a therapist, there might be a couple of week wait, but still you will get an in-depth assessment, and it takes a couple of hours.
Yeah.
We're reusing evidence-based tools to determine, whether there's any risk for you to harm yourself or whether you have depression or what your challenges are. It is a wonderful program. We are very proud of it. In addition to peer services, there's case management. So if you're having trouble navigating the housing authority or employment, we'll actually go with you and help you interact with those offices.
It's almost like this is what you meant when you said holistic.
Yes.
It was part of what you love, right?
It is. I think when I talk about holistic, I love it in terms of some of the services that I do believe the best services are really a combination of Eastern and Western. Yeah. So whether it's aromatherapy and, you know, whether it's you need, I keep a little bottle of lavender in my office. Mm. And if I'm going to have a stressful meeting, you're darn right, I'm spraying my office because there's a science about it. Yeah. It's not frou-frou stuff anymore. Yeah. Mindfulness, meditation, it works.
Yeah.
It works. It helps people self-regulate. Mm-hmm. So between that and cognitive behavior therapy or DBT or motivational interviewing, those evidence-based therapies, between the two of them, people really can heal and be well. Mm. I mean, it's pretty cool.
I love that. I love that you call in Eastern and Western. I'm an evidence-based girl. My degree is economics. Like I tend to be, you know, pretty, but I believe in feng shui.
Yes,
I spend time focusing on the energy of the house and my workspaces because you have nothing to lose.
Absolutely.
Like what is the harm of spraying lavender or putting the paired candlesticks in the right corner in my house? Like there's no
absolutely.
Loss, right?
But it's soothing.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I mean, I don't think it's a placebo effect, but even if it was, the intentionality that one takes with recognizing I am going to be in a stressful situation, I have control over a stressful situation,
sure, right.
I can write, like there's all of these pieces that just allow folks to take back a little bit of power, right, and feel a little bit more in control.
Yes.
And I think that's so important in this moment when it feels like so much is chaotic and there's so much that is
uncertain
and out of our control and that you can't impact, that, you know, just kind of remembering like I like to think of it as the co-centric kind of lotus of control that you like, I can change how I react to that and I can change the sleep that I get and I can, right, like all of those different pieces. And to mash that up with like, I'm still doing financial projections. I'm still doing cost analysis.
Right.
I'm still like, I'm
you
not like,
both
let's
end.
Throw some things in the corner and see which direction we should go in, right? Like it's not an either or, but there are a lot of ways to blend the two together. Mm-hmm. And I just really appreciate you bringing that, particularly for someone who, well, it might have been inferred, everything that you've spoken to explicitly is about best practices and evaluation and data and evidence. And there is so much now that is evidence-backed.
Absolutely. Mindfulness and meditation, even Harvard has done studies about, you know, you do it for 6 weeks or 8 weeks. There's actual brain changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you can change your brain by doing some of this stuff. In areas of your brain where you have anxiety and the fight or flight response, they see differences in that. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, the flip side of that coin, right, is that there's data that shows, and I remember learning this and being terrified in some ways, but that the continued level of stress and environmental stress that someone lives in not only changes your brain patterns and how you are living and responding to that, but that you can pass that on in the DNA and genetics to your children.
Mm. It's fascinating.
You said terrifying with this totally different way to pronounce it. You said fascinating. I heard terrifying. Like, as a mother who grew up in environmental stress and have done so many things in my life to break generational cycles and build relationships and build new habits and, you know, grow my children in great ways. This notion that like just by biologically providing life to them, I had somehow contributed to not breaking the cycles. Like, come on, can we get a break?
Right.
Those of us out here who are trying.
Absolutely.
Have you cracked that code yet, Jane?
Well, I'm working on it.
Thanks. I need you to not retire until you get that one figured out for us. That'd be great.
You know, the one thing that surprised me about Maine, because when I came up here and interviewed, it was so beautiful, and I said everybody's kayaking and hiking, and I thought everything, you know, everybody's going to be so healthy here. I was surprised to learn and to really understand the youth mental health crisis that we are experiencing.
Talk about it for a minute, please.
You know, a third of high school students report feeling sad or hopeless for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The rates of anxiety and depression in Maine youth exceed national averages. The presence of two or more adverse childhood experiences, those are those things that happen to kids or that they experience that impact the prevalence of mental illness later on, two or more adverse experiences, higher in Maine than the rest of the country. That surprised me. And one of the things we're seeing in our Lewiston Center, you know, we get about 45 walk-ins a month. We're seeing more children than we are in any of our other programs. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's reflective of the youngest need.
We have the highest number of younger individuals, and we have the lowest average age of any community in the state of Maine.
Wow.
So some of that is proportionately represented.
Yes, I think you're right about that.
And to that end, we are the state's future workforce. In so many ways. And yes. So, which only doubles down your point, right?
Yes.
You know, because again, I have a current high school senior. I've got 3 20-year-olds at home. They're not triplets, but yes, I have 4 boys. And so, like, you know, just being in touch with their own health journey and mental health journey and that of their peers, you know, not only do I think it's just in some ways like this is a hard world to navigate. Sometimes when I talk to them, they are, they have an awareness, not just a self-awareness, but a general overall awareness of the reality of the world and the complexities that I feel like my generation didn't get to understanding, processing, and comprehending until we were like in our mid-20s, which by the way is when our brains were more fully formed. And so they're having to process with not fully developed brains at a younger age. It's really hard. Yeah. Right?
Absolutely.
Like, just like that's what's, you know, and then you
right.
throw into that mix. I watched all 4 of these boys navigate the pandemic. Mm-hmm. My youngest was in 7th grade when the world shut down. So I think he got like 7 months of really living in person in middle school.
Very hard.
And then not for a number of years.
Yes.
And so, you know, fast forward to when we were coming into to the twin senior year and as Tayden is entering his senior year this year, like, just basic things like being in social environments that were co-ed, that led to flirting, that led to dating,
yes.
like just those basic things that were, I don't know, 80% of the stress and anxiety that we had back in the day. Like, am I going to get a date to the prom? And, you know, it was the 90s. It was a long time ago. But those things had they're still present. They had so many more layers of anxiety. I don't know that I know someone under 20 who doesn't speak very openly about having anxiety, whether they're diagnosed or not.
Right.
Like,
yes,
and it's
yes.
and it's the go-to one because I would like to say that, and maybe it's just how we talk about or have better awareness of what different illnesses are and what different symptoms are. But in my generation, like, it was not uncommon for people to be like, "Man, I'm so depressed." Right. And maybe it was like a tough week or a tough day. Sometimes it actually meant like I am sitting in clinical depression and have been here for a minute. But when I hear them talk about anxiety, it feels pretty clinical.
Absolutely.
Feels pretty real on the symptom side and feels almost universal.
Yes. It's fascinating and frightening, I think. You know, when you think about it, you know, our kids got cut off from all their connections during COVID. And we saw, you know, the mental health needs skyrocket. And us in the field, we all thought it would return post-COVID. It hasn't.
No.
I do think, you know, you talk about what, you know, our youth have to contend with compared to us. I mean, I didn't think about global warming or anything. School violence, really, you know, that might have been 2 kids pushing each other in the hallway. It's nothing like what our kids think about today. And then, you know, not to be trite, but social media is, I applaud those schools that don't allow phones.
Yeah.
I really do. Because, you know, you trip or you've got your skirt tucked in your underwear now. It's on, you know, somebody's got a video of it and it's shared all over the world.
Yeah.
We didn't have any of that.
No.
We didn't have any of that.
Thank God.
So I know.
If
right?
I had
think
a camera
about
with a phone in college,
right.
I don't know.
Yes.
Right?
I just think about what we did.
It was the privacy that the 90s afforded me.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it is tough for them.
Yeah.
It
mm-hmm.
really is. Mm-hmm. And I think we have created a generation of anxious kids. And when you think about it, like, only 49% of these kids are probably receiving treatment, and even less that evidence-based treatment, that stuff that we know is going to work. So it really is something that we have to focus on as a state and as a community.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other factors locally, like, this has been in the back of my mind, and I There's a number of us who were really engaged in responding to and supporting the community, victims and survivors, post October 25th. You know, here we are like a year and a half later, and you don't want to dwell on it, and you don't want to use it like a crutch or like, oh, well, it's tough because, and for those of us who are kind of deep in the work and the relational work, are very mindful of like bringing it up and referencing it. But the reality is when you think about the backlog of therapists and clinicians who can support people in this community, the wait list they have from the significant need of not just 160 plus individuals who were impacted directly that night, but the first responders who responded, the families of both of those groups of individuals, the schools. Like, I mean, just the ripple effect was really significant in this area. And one of the things I was curious about is how you're using or how you see the opportunities for telehealth treatment. Because when I think about how rural Maine is and some of our rural communities, you know, I always saw telehealth as a way of removing some barriers, not kind of replacing in-person relationships, but really supporting some of that. And, you know, kind of post October 25th, we saw the advantages of being able to say to somebody, you can use this online search and find to find a therapist who lives across the country and isn't dealing with this backlog and doesn't have the kind of additional weight that a lot of the caregivers in our community do right now. And so, you know, situationally, is doing what you do for work and doing it in this area, you know, just...
I do think telehealth has been really helpful, especially in rural areas, if they have access to a phone or a computer, if they're broadband. I do think it helps, but I also think that sitting across from someone, being able to touch them, being able to see all the body language, I think can lead to a more enriching experience. With that said, I think especially younger people are very comfortable with telehealth, very comfortable. So, you know, to me, I would support the use of telehealth, especially when it's the only thing available or you can get quicker access. You know, I do think we're gonna start to see more use of other kind of automated, for lack of a better term, use of AI in mental health in the future. One of the things Sweetser has adopted is the use of automated intelligence to take the place of like a scribe during a session. And that has really helped because you can connect. Like, I don't know about you, but even like my GP, we're starting to see people typing during your session or when you're talking to someone. This really allows you to connect, and you have, you know, we can't hire a scribe to follow around every provider, but we can use AI to do that. And, you know, I think people get nervous when they hear about AI, but they're not making any decisions. They're not treating you. It is really a tool to kind of alleviate the burden on clinicians and on providers to, you know, help them see, you know, more people, really. I don't know. What I love about the tool we adopted, it was developed and designed by clinicians, and it is for community behavioral health organizations. So it has that extra built-in security. Nothing is recorded. Yeah. Nothing is retained.
Nothing's like feeding back the learning.
No,
it's
that part. Really very nice. Yes. And I felt like it had all the safeguards in place. But we were also an early adopter. I believe we're the first in Maine. But I do think, like, we're going to start to see virtual reality headsets in terms of training clinicians and in terms of, you know, teaching people, you know, how to self-regulate and de-escalate themselves. We're going to start to see more and more of that. I mean, you know, a lot of folks are using that Calm app, which is pretty good, actually.
I've looked
at it. So there are, you know, this is the new world, and you know, we might as well embrace it.
I think that's right.
No risk, no gain.
No, I love that it's no gain and not no reward. I just like that's gonna. I'm gonna write that on my wall after the meeting because I think that's right. It just brings me back to leadership being explicit about their risk adversity. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see you less risk adverse, obviously, because I believe in taking risks. But if you're gonna be risk adverse, I just need you to own it.
Yes.
I need you to own it. I need for strategic conversations, planning conversations, programmatic work to not be limited. You know, oh, it'd be great if we did X, Y, and Z, and you get 9/10 of the way there, and you're like, oh, but I don't have the stomach for that. Like, ah, okay, this is really helpful for us to surface on the front end, isn't
it? Right.
So I have a really fantastic board, and I'm so grateful for the leaders on my board. But we did a strategic planning process in 2023 for the next 3 years. And in that, we named up front, like, what's our risk adversity? How do we embrace an abundance mindset? What does it look like to shift these things? And they leaned into it and have led through it for the, you know, for the last year and a half. And so I'm really grateful for that. But it's rare for specifically for boardrooms to have real honest conversations about risk.
Yeah.
So
one of the things I'm proud of at Sweetser is when I got there, we did a SWOT analysis as part of our strategic plan, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And one of our weaknesses was our resistance to change. I mean, what I used to say is, you know, the good thing about Sweetser is we've been around for almost 200 years. The bad thing about Sweetser is we've been around for almost 200 years. Because we like to do things the same. And we just redid it. We didn't do it the second year, but we redid it. And one of our strengths now is that we're not afraid to be first, and we're not afraid to take chances.
Kudos.
And I really like that, you know, we've been able to bring folks along that, you know, nothing will get better without change.
Yeah.
Nothing will get better. So that's been pretty exciting for us. So
I love that. Mark, before we go into our questions, things you'd like to ask or contribute, you always have this golden nugget, and I always steal the opportunity from you, and I have vowed to start asking sooner.
Oh, stop.
Not that you don't get your pieces in a little bit here and there, but like, what would you like to...
I have one very important question for Jane.
Yes.
Early in the conversation, you said that you're at a point in your career where you don't need the praise or the credit.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever considered running for president of the United States?
I always say, this is my last job.
Come on.
No, I heard that as a no, Mark. Right. I don't think she's running.
I had to try.
It is a leadership mindset we could do more with. Yeah. A little bit more of that out in the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I just thought that's a... When you said that, I'm so glad that you picked up on that, Mark, because when you said that, like, I am of the mindset in terms of my own team and my own work that if there's praise to be given, it's named and doled out publicly and immediately. Someone's like, oh, Shanna, your last blah, blah, blah was whatever. Like, oh, that wasn't me. That's Katie. That's Becca. That's Sam. That's my team. It's Brian. It's, you know, I'm the first to say that. If someone says, I really struggled with X, Y, Z at your last event, I take it all.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that was your experience. Thank you so much. I love to learn from things and make it better. And there won't be one name dropped, right? And that's and it's not that we won't go talk about it internally, but like you shower praise and you absorb criticism as a leader. And I
public
just
public praise, private criticism is the mantra.
Yeah. So I'm a firm believer in that. And I've recently had some uncomfortable reminders that is not as prevalent as I would appreciate. Not just the public stuff. Not only the headlines, but in some real honest to God, hardworking, you know, kind of work on the ground work. I've just been reminded that some leaders really take a very different approach, and I see the impact on culture and staff and outcomes and impact that they're aiming for in the work itself. And I love that you said that. And I have a hard time believing that it's just the stage that you're at in your career. I would believe you probably have spent most of your career showering and sharing praise.
You know what? You can have the best CEO in the world, but if you're not nourishing and encouraging your staff, that person, you will never be successful.
Correct.
And if you don't know that or understand that as a CEO, you're going to be doomed.
Yeah.
So you've really got to lift up everybody in your organization.
Yeah. And I can attest to that.
Right?
I can attest to it. It's felt. It's absolutely felt.
Yeah.
I feel like we are all one big family, you know?
You can tell when people are doing lip service to that. I think it's one of the most obvious, quick ways to transparently see through someone that like, oh, you say that because it sounds good, but you don't, that's not your values.
Yes.
You don't live that. You don't walk that. And it's very obvious in the space. I would hazard a guess it was probably obvious in Oklahoma and New York State. has nothing to do with age or retirement. I'm calling you out.
I don't know.
I'm calling you out. I think you were always maybe like that a little bit, which is a really wonderful thing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other nuggets or offices that you'd like to see Jane run for?
Just one quick one. You brought up Simone Biles going public with her struggles. Yeah. Are you familiar with the, I think it just came out earlier this week, the Boston Red Sox outfielder, Jaron Duran?
Vaguely about that.
Yeah,
yes.
So this is a guy who hasn't seen 30 years old yet. He is handsome. He's a professional athlete. He plays for the Boston Red Sox. Yeah. He tried to take his own life 3 years ago. Yeah. Netflix did a documentary on the Red Sox, and he said he trusted the crew with Netflix, and he decided to share his story. Mm. And it just premiered, I think it premiered Monday. The company he was affiliated with is called Samaritan. Does that ring a bell? I believe it's a mental health crisis center.
Yeah.
After Jaron's story aired, their calls and texts increased by 5 times.
I love that. That's so great.
I think it's great and brave.
Yes.
And I just
that's
wish
wonderful.
We weren't such a...
We did need a Netflix.
We weren't
special.
Such a celebrity obsessed culture.
That is true.
Where
that
we need, true. You know, where that's gonna spur
that's
us on to go public.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah, or to seek help.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you remember the name of it?
I think the documentary is called Clubhouse.
Okay.
A year.
Find that.
Yeah, it's called Clubhouse. A year with the Boston Red Sox, and it's like an 8-part series.
I did hear about that. But
that's
I'm gonna look for it now.
Yeah.
What do you know about gender as it relates to people seeking help, seeking support?
What I
before mean, I just throw a hypothesis out there, is lobbed into the universe that's nowhere near accurate. Mrs. Data, what do you know about how gender relates to people accessing and seeking care?
I think traditionally you will find more females will reach out for care than males. I think if you look at who struggles more or what the data tells us in terms of deaths by suicide, you see more with men than with women because they tend to use more lethal means. Yeah. They tend to use guns. Mm-hmm. Women tend to use overdose so they can be they get rescued or they can be revived. So, yeah, you tend to see that.
It gives me just enough courage to still love my hypothesis out there. Which is, I'm not surprised by that. And I think it's not just celebrity. I think it's that. And I think that's a really great reflection on society as a whole.
Yes.
But I think a prominent, well-known man being able to say it, I would be curious how much of that fivefold increase was men.
Yeah.
Right? Because part of the data that you're naming is women, the stigma is stronger for men. Let me start by saying that there is a stronger stigma. Right. You have to be
tough.
Women ask for help and cry and men don't. And so I see that shifting, much like we talked about at the earlier part of the conversation, but the stigma is stronger for men. The need to be, you know, unaffected or to handle it yourself, I think is stronger for men. And so it wouldn't surprise me if both having an athlete and a male specifically being able to say, I got help. Look, I'm still working and doing well.
Right.
Which is because it's not just I managed to overcome a mental health issue and now I'm, so many of those stories end with, and now I'm living on disability.
Right.
And just, right? Like I'm still killing it out there on the socks is a very different narrative to come from a man. And I'd be curious how much of that fivefold, I bet it did not fit a gender split equal to the population that it served, right?
Yeah.
But I would be wondering if that's a real piece. And when you find that more men are passing, I think that is also a reflection of less men getting help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not just the fact that they're using, kind of harder catch means, but I think all of that's related. And I say that as a mom of four boys, right? So they're very proactively having conversations around gender and stigma.
That's
interesting.
That's a good catch.
Clubhouse.
Yep.
Must watch list for this weekend.
Yeah, check it out.
Yes.
We always close with a segment we call Looking Back and Leading Forward. Mark's radio voice will lull us into our closure.
Our closing segment is called Looking Back, Leading Forward, where we invite our guests to share advice or insights from their experiences to help lead us forward.
What would you tell a younger version of yourself, Jane, just starting out in the work in today's policy and communities landscape?
I'd probably tell them two things. One is integrity is very, very important. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you have to earn the trust of people. You know, not telling folks what it is, it doesn't help them. Having those tough conversations when you need to, I think is important. And I think to really understand that you need to be honest, you need to be forthcoming, you need to be, you need to engender trust, that people feel like, you know, what you say is what you mean and what you will do. Mm-hmm. It's easy to put those pretty words in your website or on paper, but you need to live them and your decisions need to reflect them. So I would probably say that.
I mean, we'll give you a second one, but that one's pretty powerful. I just want you to know.
Yeah. You can close
on
that.
Yeah, I just say it.
My second one would be, and this one's more for me because I always felt very strongly about integrity, but I think what I've learned over my career, you don't always have to win. That sometimes, you know, finding a compromise is okay.
Yeah.
I'm competitive by nature.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if I would go back to my younger self, I'd say, you know, sometimes you don't have to win. Mm.
That's been the hardest one for me.
Yeah, right? It's like we like to win, right?
Yeah. Well, there's this really great book, Working with People You Don't Like or Even Really Trust. I think there's actually like a third descriptor in there that makes it even more negative. But like, it's really like, how do you work with people across difference in a way to get to compromise, right? So like, how do you hold your integrity? Because I also, integrity is like my core value. Yeah. How do you hold your integrity while working with people of whom don't try.
Exactly.
Don't even try.
Exactly.
To compromise and not win, because already you're in a kind of dynamic where you're like, I'm gonna take that right down, right? You're already kind of positioned to be like, I'm not gonna fault that.
Yes.
And so how do you navigate those two things when they're at odds with each other? It's a really great book on figuring out,
I'll
like
have to look that.
Yeah, it's, I'll get you the real name of it, because I'm sure that was close but probably not it. Like, it may be enough to search, but I don't know. Elizabeth, any last thoughts? Or you're already pretty young, so I don't know. Yes. Flipping that, like, what do you hope you can say to your older version of yourself? Or
I think even in my short, my 21 whole years on this earth, I think I can say to my younger self that, you know, failure can be a really good thing.
Mm,
failure can be a really, really good thing. Yep. And, you know, my little failures, nothing catastrophic yet. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there will be that will come. But I think remembering that throughout your life and learning from your mistakes, I think is a huge thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think any failure you learn from is not not a fail.
Yes.
It's
a lesson.
It's a lesson.
Well, and bold of you to have figured that out, because I was well into my 30s when the universe had beat that particular lesson into me. And so you're doing a great job. You two are doing a great job, because I think it's a really important lesson. Thank you both so much for taking time with us today on the podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. Yeah. I did too. Yeah, these are important issues. So thank you for having us.
Thanks for making them human and real issues. And doing so with hope.
Yes.
Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah.